update on RFP.
I just want to let the council members know that the deadline for submittals on the RFP for housing above parking ramp number 6 was this past Friday afternoon, and the city did not receive any proposals for that particular project at this time. We had about a half a dozen people show up at a pre-proposal meeting back in early August that had questions, and our consultants and architects were there to answer questions and whatnot. So both Richard and I, Richard and I were both kind of disappointed when we found out that no one submitted a request for a proposal here at this time. We're going to try to follow up with some developers that we know and just ask them what their thoughts were as to why. I'm only speculating, but I'm guessing that a lot of the developers have a lot of projects in the pipeline right now, so they're really busy. And then the second aspect to it is there may be some reluctancy right now because the developers may be afraid they're not going to be able to have construction labor available. I think a lot of construction laborers are going to be heading down to Texas and Florida for doing hurricane damage rebuilding. So for a long time, we may have a shortage of construction labor up in this part of the country. I'm only speculating, but that would be.
And I think one of the options we talked about early on is that we may decide, and I know there's some increased cost, but we may decide to put in footings and so forth such that it could be expanded at a later date.
The structural support will be there.
Okay.
It's in it.
So
the potential doesn't go away.
Right. So we'll just maybe have to go look at it again in the future. We can go back with another RFP, or if a developer comes to us and expresses interest, we can bring it back to the council at that point.
Okay.
So with the RFP not getting any submissions, so basically go on the shelf as something we can keep available for economic development going forward, correct?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
All right, thanks for the update. We'll move on to our agenda then, and our first item is the community block grant allocations. Brent, you want to run us through this?
Sure. As the council is aware, back on September 4th of this month, the council did hold a public hearing where the council did receive testimony from those agencies that applied for block grant funding for 2018. The purpose of today's meeting is to allocate the estimated dollars that the city is anticipating and receiving for 2018, and then on October 2nd, which is the next council meeting, the council will allocate those dollars for 2018. As customary in the past, the council has provided us with the council's allocations of those monies for each council member. I did hand out a spreadsheet that shows those dollar amounts and those programs by each council member. And as in previous years, the council has decided that those programs that receive four or more votes by the council members would receive the allocation funding for 2018. So based on the information I received back, there were only four of the programs received four or more votes. The first program would be the Women's Shelter. The second is the ABC, which is Building Center, then the Single Family Rehab Program, and the Administrative Cost. So based on those four programs, it looks like the council at this point would allocate about $483,000 of the estimated $525,000 that we anticipate receiving next year, which would leave about $41,000 unallocated. The council could discuss now if you want to allocate that money in some other programs on this sheet that were maybe close to receiving four votes, or we could leave that money unallocated and see where we come in next year as far as how much money do we get from HUD, and then we could allocate that money elsewhere to only the programs that the council votes on at the next council meeting to receive allocations.
Mr. Campion.
I guess you know, obviously, I've advocated last year that we move the CDBG funding to be 100% for single-family rehab. But given the council's desire to fund some of these other projects, I would encourage the council to fully fund these other requests before we subdivide that money further. to make sure we get some of these projects fully funded instead of continuing to partial fund projects. So we could almost, if we fully funded the two other projects that had four votes and put the rest in the single family rehab or left unallocated, I think I could support that.
I was just going to say, I agree with that sentiment in a slightly different sense, in that some of these requests are for things like a parking lot or a roof repair, and funding them half, you know, you're not going to fix half the roof or do half the parking lot. So that's why I was tending to want to fund all or at least most of some of these, like exercise abilities and the women's shelter. But Mr. Hickey?
I'd like to go to the projects that only received three votes and see if we couldn't rally some support. I think the spreading it around is a excellent idea. That's what I tried to do. So there is, rather than just, you know, throw it back into the general, I'd rather see if anybody would want to lend support to some of these projects and only got three votes.
Mr. Bilbeck?
I would think that we should fund the four, fully fund the ones that got four votes, and then whatever's left, if that can work with the three votes, I'm fine with that.
Mr. Ruff?
I did the math here. Public, 21,300 would leave us.
You should do math.
I know. I'm pretty confident with it. 41.1 is what we had remaining. The 19.8 would be the funding of the two remaining ones that got four votes, and that would give us 21,300 to do either keep as a bank or put it towards any of those that receive three votes.
Mr. Wilder?
I am going to advocate for focusing on the one with four votes for a couple of reasons. Actually, staff has told us many times when it comes to the allocation of these funds that more is not better. Spreading it around is very bad from an administrative burden standpoint. And that's part of the reason why I followed Mr. Campion's lead and, you know, put the money where the, you know, where one of the priorities are, and part is just to keep it simple. I have great respect for a lot of the projects on here that received four votes and a lot of respect for ones that received zero votes. And what I would say is that certainly you can see the ballpark range too, where folks were coming in who did support those projects. So moving those up, I don't think we can fully fund those two with the remainder, but we can certainly make some more progress towards what those most common priorities were.
I mean, it does seem like we used to get our HUD funding back in the spring, and it keeps on getting later and later every year. And we received it for 2017 just earlier this month, so it has. Funding for HUD keeps on getting pushed back in the year, so it's
the fewer people
it's
we
harder
have
to spend that money right away.
One other aspect is the fewer people that could potentially be disappointed is another aspect here, is that if we fully fund a few of these projects, the reality is we've all heard the inklings about what's going to happen with this funding and whether or not this could continue to be available. So being able to communicate with a few partners that expectation and how that'll work out, the need for housing, and I think you know, I won't do as good a job as our planning and administrative area will do, but the need for the single family housing, it's going to be the most affordable housing stock, and keeping people in their homes where they already are is the cheapest way to keep them housed. So I think it's most affordable, not the cheapest. It's the most affordable way to keep them housed. So I think you know, continuing to make sure we put unallocated money in there is a good idea. I don't think we could put too much in there, the reality is. But I think in terms of the 21,000 that Councilman Ruska and I have both independently calculated in public, being available, I think leaving that unallocated right now gives us both an option to later revisit it, or the option to insulate ourselves if there's any reduction or unexpected kind of consequence with that. So.
Mr. Wojcik.
The other thing I would add too is it's important to remember that different programs, the funds stay around and they help the community forever, or they disappear after a one-time allocation. And the way that we currently have the single-family home rehab fund structured, where we have an interest rate in there that's sufficient to cover inflation, means that as we put funds in those programs, we're actually growing a program balance that stays with the community and helps us with affordable housing on into the future.
Mr. Ruska?
It's been pointed out that if we just made it simplified to just do one area, that would make it a lot easier administratively. Is there any chance that we would cut down the administrative costs then if we just kept it simple to one allocation?
Potentially correct, because it would be less staff time, monitoring those other programs that we're not allocating anymore, but we would.
I'd like to ask Planning Director Baker to speak to that if possible, because that's your area, isn't it?
It is, and yes, there would be less demand on the administrative side of this because we have to be in contact with all the grant teams. We have to do the solicitation, we have to do the notification of who's received and who hasn't, but there's the paperwork and the tracking throughout the year, too, that happens. So certainly, you have one versus 7, 12, or whatever.
So if I may finish this, we're down to three groups right now that we are agreeing to, and then will this be notified to all the other groups, kind of why, and I know some of them don't sometimes kind of wonder if they ever get, they don't hear, so are we, do we notify them and follow up?
I believe Taryn will notify the groups after the decision on October 2nd, the council, because this comes before you in the next meeting for final allocation.
Right, okay.
So the administrative, there's program admin built into single family rehab. If we were not to fund any external organizations, would this last $50,000 still need to be allocated for administration?
To the rehab program?
It's a little bit confusing.
It's two pieces.
Yep, I'm seeing one where it seems that the program and the administration are baked into a single line item. And then I see a separate administrative line item. And I'm wondering if we just fund the one that's baked into, do we need to fund the other administrative line item at all, or is that already covered?
No, it's not.
Okay,
because
all right.
Because there's actually separate positions doing different things.
So we need that second position, regardless of whether or not we fund any of these organizations with CDBG money.
The second position takes care of all the hearing notices, writing the action plan, and all the other requirements that HUD requires us to do in order to receive this money.
Okay, beyond, okay.
Yeah, and the other program is just the administration of the same thing.
Thank you. That is helpful.
Mr. Steele?
Yeah, well, I think Brent just touched on it. I think a part of that money goes to doing the action plan updates, and that's one of the larger expenses of the admin, under that admin bucket. That's a HUD requirement that we can't get around. So you may be able to reduce your admin cost to some degree, but there's always going to be some associated with that.
So in future versions of the spreadsheet, can we just have that fixed? Like if we're saying that this isn't actually an eligible item, let's just drop it out of the total we have to allocate and fix the line item, and then we don't have to talk about it. Because every year this comes up where it almost seems like we have an option, but what I'm hearing is they're not actually an option.
Yeah.
We're going to fund these positions anyway. Is that true? Would the rest of council feel that way? I don't know.
Staff likes it when we pay them.
And yeah, you do have those fixed costs for administration.
Mr. Ruskin?
I guess I'd like to piggyback on what Councilmember Campion said. Is I think the more of these people that are out there that at least know that they've got a chance and are getting funded on occasion, maybe not every year, but at least have an opportunity, gives us some support to keeping the program going. And if we start to lose that where we're not funding any of it, then I think we start to maybe have a little bigger battle on our hands, so something to keep in mind.
All right, so where are we at? First on the question of, are we saying that we want to fully fund those that receive 4 votes?
Yes.
I would like...
Go ahead.
Sorry, didn't... I would like to see that happen. If we have, since we have the money to fully fund those that are voted for 4, I think those should be fully funded.
Well, then the follow-on question is, then what do we do with the balance? Because all we're really talking about is funding 2 things,
yeah,
plus the single-family rehab.
I thought we left it unallocated so that we can adjust if we have to.
Yeah, we can live with that. Mm-hmm.
And that's the $21,300.
Right.
Okay.
According to my underlying math.
2 people.
Got it.
I got it.
By right. Consensus.
All right.
Yep.
You got what you need?
Yep.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Brent.
We will move on then to our Emerald Ash Borer plan update.
Jeff's setting up and just giving a word of introduction. You know, the EAP management plan was approved by council in March of last year. We've been requested to come and give you an update on our progress and also the advancement of the board, which Jeff is prepared to do. And we may have some other tree related questions at the end of this, but we'll be prepared to come. So, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. Yeah, my discussion is going to cover two topics mainly. I'll first I'll delve into our EAB management and show you what's happening in the field to date. And then secondly, I just want to give a little bit of talk a little bit about urban forest master plan. There's been a movement to try to get funding to create a master plan for Rochester's urban forest. And also there's been interest in a tree preservation ordinance. So I want to talk about those things and maybe make some clarifications and answer any questions that you might have. So in terms of EAB, ML-4, and what's happening in the field, this is kind of a synopsis of what's happened to date. And really, we began our management in 2015. You approved the EAB management plan in March of 2016, so that's when that technically went into effect. But in 2015, we actually had money from the DNR to do some preemptive work for EAB. That was initially right after we found out that it was here or south of town. So in 2015-16, we removed and replaced 54 trees in the southwest quadrant, utilizing about $40,000 of grant money that was made available after EAB was found here. We've been doing inspections every single year since 2015. So in August of 2014 is when we identified the first tree as being infested, and that was at the intersection of 63 and I-90, if you'll recall. So since then, we've begun annual inspections of all public ash trees, and there's 6,000 trees to review annually, and that takes quite a bit of time. So I'll go over that. But I wanted to note that in 2016 and 17, so over this last year, EAB or ash tree removals has escalated to 428 trees, and this map just kind of shows how they're dispersed through the city. It definitely started from the southwest, but it has moved into every quadrant. We've confirmed trees in every single quadrant in our city, which is alarming. One thing to point is I put the EAB death curve down at the bottom, and just to remind you, that's just a curve that shows how tree mortality exponentially increases over time, and the total length of that curve is typically about 8 to 10 years. So the beginning of the curve, all your ash trees are alive, and 8 to 10 years later, they're all dead. And that's simply a function of how quickly the population can build up to the point where it will kill every ash tree in its path. These are pictures taken between the airport and Stewartville. On the west side of Highway 63, if you drive south, you'll see this. Every single dead tree in that picture is an ash tree. So, and you can find similar situations west of Hart Farm development, for instance, outside of city limits. Wholesale tree mortality is occurring outside of the city limits. And it's moving into town now. We've just started to find our first completely dead trees in town that have been killed by EAB. And what's that cost in city staff time? So this is year by year what our department has spent. In those early years, that's largely inspections is what used up that time. But you can see in 2017 it spiked dramatically, and we're not done. Those numbers, 2017 to date was as of the 20th of September, and we're anticipating something around 2,900 to 3,000 hours total when it's all said and done, because we will be continuing inspections much earlier this year. It consumed us last winter. Typically those inspections start in March, because that's when you can really see the woodpecker damage that's occurring to these trees. They really get active in March, and it becomes super easy to diagnose. But we're stuck having to start those inspections in November and December this year, just because of the number of tree removals that we have to manage and the amount of staff time it takes to do that. This is what we spent through our CIP funding, which is our diseased tree removal and reforestation account. 2015, we virtually had nothing. We relied on DNR money. In 2016, we immediately began buying chemical to treat trees, and that's expensive. And so in 2016, most of the money we spent was on chemicals. To date in 2017, we spent $230 out of that account. And We were budgeted $141,000 in the last budgeting process for this. Why have we exceeded that? Largely because of unexpected numbers of trees that are being removed. We're further along in that curve, I believe, than year two or three even. Our request for 2018 is going to end up being, and I did note that you added a staff member, and that's greatly appreciated and much needed in 2017. 2018, our request will be $375,000, and I'll get into what that covers in the next slide. And then our CIP requests for the upcoming 2019 through 2022 are going to be $350, $450, $600, and $600. And this does vary from what the budget that we laid out in our management plan. But the reason for that is that we're attempting to try to flatten that curve and not have that spike of $750,000, you know, 4 years out. That we're finding that we're behind. We weren't able to get our replanting of any trees that were removed on public property this year. Didn't have money to do that. So looking at 2018 specifically, how that 375 breaks down is that 50,000 is going to be included or requested for the development of an urban forest master plan. The remaining $325,000 of that is going to be for EAV management. That's an increase, I think, by the plan. Our budget called for about $300,000 in year three, and we've asked for $325 to help offset and get the trees replanted that were removed this year that we haven't been able to do. We're also asking for another arborist position, and I believe that's critical, and we can talk about that in another slide a little bit further down. And then just a note that the Urban Forest Master Plan and Urban Tree Canopy analysis cost estimate is roughly $90,000. So $50,000 of that has been put into CIP, and we would have to figure out where the remaining balance would come to fund that effort. So just to recap our field operations, I believe that we're further along in the mortality curve, as I suggested. Tree removal quantities are higher than we anticipated. We've jumped from 54 to 430, and I'm afraid to see what's going to happen this year, quite frankly. What has been a good thing is that the cost for average tree removal and replacement has been slightly lower than we expected. But I should note the $425 is our average cost to remove and grind the stump of every ash tree that we've removed to date. What isn't included in there, we used about $1,000 average per tree when we created that plan for budgeting purposes. We haven't included replanting. If we utilize the park dedication program that we have for replanting, we would add about $250 per tree for the tree replacement itself. And we exceeded our budget in 2017 of $141,000, and that was simply to remove and treat the infested trees. This is putting a strain on our local vendors. It's hard for them to keep up with these, especially in the winter when we're doing these wholesale removals. And our fear is that could drive up costs in the future. And 2017 budget did not allow for replants to occur. Chemical treatments have remained on schedule, and to date we've treated about 1,000 trees. Staffing challenges. I wanted to talk a little bit about this because right now while we're in our budget talks and talking about staffing positions, I just wanted to let everyone here know that we believe that we're managing 100,000 trees. We don't have 100,000 trees in inventory, but we do have a considerable inventory of public trees on streets and in parks. Where we're lacking this information is the 100-foot buffers along all the trails that go through the woods and 100-foot buffers around parks that we really don't have inventory information, but we know we have to manage. We have to inspect those trees and we have to stay on top of their removals before they fall on somebody. We did some inventory work last winter through a contractor and found that we have about an additional 10,000 ash trees along paths and trails throughout town that those were not even included in our original EAV management plan numbers. So there is, you know, a component here that we didn't know going in. Current industry standards indicate that you should have one arborist for every 10,000 trees, and that's so that you can keep up with pruning schedules. And currently, we have 6 arborists on our staff. Our EAD management plan calls for 2 additional arborists that you will be presented with during budget talks here, one this year and one next year. And I do feel that those are critical positions that we need to be able to stay on top of this problem that's taking over really our operations. And similar organizations tend to exceed these standards for staffing. Okay, so that kind of wraps up my Emerald Ash Borer management talk. And now I will move on to a discussion briefly about Urban Forest Master Plan. If there's any questions, I can entertain them now or at the end.
Mr. Campy?
There's another insect problem this summer. Is it beetle of some variety?
Japanese beetle.
Japanese beetle. Is that exacerbating problems, or is that just a separate other problem for homeowners to deal with?
Well, it's a separate problem in that it attacks different trees, uh-huh. And generally that's not a problem that's going to kill a tree.
Mortal, okay.
Yeah, unless it's a stress tree to begin with, and there's other reasons that it's not healthy enough to resist the attack.
Okay.
Generally that will affect lindens, elms, crab apples, to some degree maple trees.
But not ash trees.
But not ash okay. trees.
Just every other tree.
Right.
The ash trees will die, the other trees will be defoliated.
But watch those trees that you're seeing affected by them now. They should leaf out next spring, and really until that beetle, reaches its adult life cycle again late summer next year, they'll look fine until they
get eaten again.
Right. But by the time that happens, they've already set their buds for next year. They're pretty much set for the next year. They don't really need a whole lot from that set of leaves at that point.
Okay. All right. Mr. Mayor?
The treatment of the trees, is it too early to tell? Is that really working as well as you would hope?
It's working well. I will point you toward the trees at Soldiers Field. Those were some of the first ash trees that we treated. And the idea is that ash trees have been attacked by native borers for many years and have had other issues that have stressed them. Now that they're being treated for EAB, it's also going to help address these other issues. And so, in theory, we will actually be improving the condition of those trees. And Soldiers Field trees look wonderful.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson?
When you look at chemical treatments on the trees, do you notify homeowners if it's on the boulevard, or do you notify people in the park when you spray?
Well, we don't spray.
Oh, you don't spray. How do you do the chemical treatments?
The chemical treatment is injected in.
Excellent.
And the chemical that we use is a non-neonicotoid, so it does not affect pollinators. So it's injected into the tree, and it stays within the tree. And it's been proven that pollinators don't utilize ash trees when they're flying, getting their food. Ash trees are a windblown, open-pollinated species, so they don't rely on pollinators. So it's very safe that way.
Excellent. Thank you.
Mr. Ruska?
Jeff, I appreciate all the stuff. It seems a little bit like a sprint going through that. I was jotting stuff down and trying to, since we didn't have anything ahead of time. So maybe you could send that out to us is all. I mean, I tried to get a bunch of facts, but I also had the same question about those 1,000 trees of how we're coming on those. And, overall, I think, I get the ratio of a 1 per 10,000 trees, but, that's all. We're making progress in that area, and there's a lot of other needs out there, so I think, hope you understand that we're trying to balance this out best we can. But I've noticed the concern of the local subcontractors that seem like they're swamped with stuff, and so, it's just one of those deals. We have to do it the best we can, I guess.
Understand. My point was that I feel like we've been understaffed even before EAB got here, so I just wanted to put those numbers out there to show you what
we should
be aiming for.
Thank you.
Mr. Woodard?
Well, we had the opportunity to more fully fund forestry last year, and I know it was a point that some of us brought up that the EAB is not real good at negotiating with us in terms of when it's going to destroy our trees. So we kind of, the costs are what the costs are, and I recognize that going into the budget cycle this time around. I did want to ask you, though, another one. We also have some other things like oak wilt that we've had trees that are, what other things are affecting trees and having trees cut down in the community?
Well, Dutch elm disease, and I actually have another slide that's going to show you both our the ash tree removals and Dutch elm disease removals. Those are big ones. We've done about 360 Dutch elm or American elm removals due to Dutch elm disease. So that's the other, those are the big three, oak wilt, Dutch elm disease, and EED.
So the one that scares me a little bit is it sounds like there's some reasons to believe that some of the elm trees that we thought were disease resistant might not be disease resistant. Are you seeing that in the forestry department at all?
Yes, we are.
So, doesn't blunt it for anyone.
You know, they were termed resistant, not immune. And they're, and so for whatever the reason, it does seem like the resistant varieties are getting DED, yes. So we've taken a step back. Those trees require a lot of maintenance in their first 10 or 15 years as well.
Yes.
And so for both of those reasons, we've decided to just cool it on planting hybrid elms for a while in hopes that research will catch up and we'll figure out what's going on with the disease aspects, but also so that we're not overwhelmed with trees that we can't keep up with.
Okay. Well, you're kind of a... kind of depressing for this point. Do you do children's parties or?
Sorry.
All right.
Jeff, identifying the trees that are infected is one thing. Once you identify them, how long does it take you to get them out, and what's the chance of additional spreading in that time period?
Well, sanitation is important, so the quicker you can remove them, the better effect you'll have on reducing the population of adults. So we put a time frame of 20 days on our disease tree removals, and that is simply to get them out of the system and take away that threat of infesting or infecting other trees. With EAB, during the period of adult flight season, which is from May 1st until October 1st, best management practices dictate that you just leave them where they're at, so you don't do anything with them. If we identify them, we'll mark them, but we won't have the homeowners do anything with them until after October 1st. That just reduces the possibility of starting a new infestation somewhere else.
Mr. Hickey? So with disease trees that we remove, I know the gentleman on Broadway had the kiln that could destroy it. Is that where do we go with them?
That's one option. There's two approved wood waste facilities. ProCut Firewood is the one you're
thinking of.
And then Hathaway's. And both of those companies have made a commitment to deal with this wood within 5 days of it coming to them.
Perfect. Thank you.
Cool.
Okay.
And maybe you'll get to this under the Urban Forest Master Plan, but we got to talk about invasives some as well. Invasives, particularly buckthorn, is one of buckthorn and garlic mustard or.
You know, that isn't a part of my discussion necessarily, but the Urban Forest Master Plan certainly does address invasive species and managing natural areas for that.
I mean, it's one thing, which I know we have huge areas that are, you know, affected by these invasives, but it's quite another when we have city lots where the invasives are being allowed to run wild.
Right.
And we don't have a way of, you know, forcing owners to be responsible right now. So that is something that would be potentially covered by this?
Yes.
Okay.
That would certainly be analyzed.
All right. Why don't you go ahead?
If you want me to slow down, I will. I was just trying to be sensitive.
When we ask lots of questions, it's our fault and not yours. So.
Okay.
You hear that, Paul?
Ask more questions.
Okay, so here are the three topics I'll discuss in the last part of my talk here. Our Urban Forest Master Plan and why it's important. The Urban Tree Canopy Assessment and what that is. And then a little bit about tree preservation ordinance. So I can't begin this discussion without talking about the benefits that trees provide, because that's why we're doing it. They're providing a real benefit to the city, which is tangible and can be calculated. And some of these benefits include that they can slow down and reduce floodwaters at every single rain event. Trees are mini reservoirs that store water and keep it from hitting the storm sewers at the same time. And without them, we would have to invest a lot more money in storm sewers to keep up with that water. So that's one of the main benefits that we get. They can improve the longevity of city infrastructure. They'll make streets last longer. You don't have to resurface them as often if it's a shaded street versus a street that's in the sunshine. Of course, there are There is competition with sidewalks, and I'm fully aware of that here. And there are ways to prevent that as well, but right now, that, you know, those systems aren't being put in place. But they will improve the longevity of streets, of stormwater infrastructure. They make our cities more livable. They provide us a sense of community. They increase water quality by reducing runoff. They provide habitat. They decrease urban heat. They decrease pollution, both gaseous and particulate pollution. They save energy in both summer and even more importantly winter by creating wind buffers. And they increase human health and decrease healthcare costs. So those benefits are tangible. And this next slide attempts to explain that. I use this tree as an example because I've had a homeowner that's wanted us to cut down a 45-inch diameter silver maple that's in front of their house because they're afraid it's going to fall on them. And the tree is sound, and we've done inspections on this tree annually, and there's nothing wrong with the tree to believe that it will fail and cause property damage. When I inputted that silver maple into the National Tree Benefit Calculator, this is a tool provided by the U.S. Forest Service, that silver maple is returning $535 in annual benefit. If you look at that pie chart, it shows a breakdown of those costs. $208 is directly related to stormwater mitigation. The next biggest chunk of the pie is property values. Trees do raise property values. And then the other pieces, natural gas savings is the $58, the gray chunk. So that's winter savings of energy from trees creating a buffer and reducing wind so that the boundary zone of heat around our homes is left intact, and it helps us save energy. So you can go to this National Tree Benefit Calculator and input any tree species. It's going to ask for your zip code because it's regional. Our trees only photosynthesize half the year, and those benefits are calculated on canopy size and the amount of time that they photosynthesize. Okay, now an urban forest master plan, which I believe is a starting point before we start creating city policies like tree preservation ordinances, that we really need to analyze our community forests that we have, and an urban forest master plan will do that in combination with the tree canopy assessment. So the urban forest master plan will help us identify stakeholders and partners and identify a unified vision for our urban forest. It will take input from many different partners, the public, in helping us decide and guide how Rochester wants to see its community fororests. From my perspective, most importantly, it's a decision-making tool that will help us achieve goals and benchmark our progress, much like the Park System Master Plan that was developed and is used daily in decision-making. It's a strategic roadmap to help set community-wide canopy goals. It will help identify strengths, weaknesses, and threats to our urban forest. It will help provide equitable urban forest distribution and management. It will help us shift from reactive to proactive management. And I really feel like right now we are stuck in this reactive pattern, and we just can't get to that proactive management. It will help us to identify and implement best management practices, and it will help institute policy changes that will help support urban forestry goals. So those are the main things that, in my opinion, that the Urban Forest Master Plan will do for us. The Urban Tree Canopy Assessment, that is using remote sensing and LIDAR data, that is an analysis of our canopy cover, and it will show where we have canopy, it will show age and height distribution and species distribution. It can help quantify the number of trees in our community. It can help identify trends in canopy cover throughout the city and over time. One of the most important values, in my opinion, is that it will provide a cost-benefit analysis of our, and a monetary value of our community forest. And these numbers tend to be staggering in the tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollar value in that urban asset. It will help us study the structure of the urban forest, as I mentioned, and it will show how tree benefits are distributed equitably across the city. Again, the benefits, I mean, that's what this all gets down to, is what we're getting back from these trees. So these are the maps I indicated earlier. On the left is the DED removals that we've done throughout the city, fairly widespread as you can see. We still have a lot of elm trees in our inventory. I believe there's still over 5,000 just on public property in our inventory. And
are those the old school or the hybrid?
Most of those would be American elms, but it would include the hybrids that we have in inventory. But there's an untold number on private property, and that's the same map of the EAD removals. But in combination, you know, that's 750 trees that we've removed this year just to those two disease problems. Now I wanted to just talk a little bit about a tree preservation ordinance. Because I feel like maybe there's some confusion over what this is exactly. Essentially, it serves to protect the existing and future canopy cover of our city. And it will require mitigation for lost canopy as Rochester grows. It's not intended to make every tree sacred. In fact, this ordinance will be drafted and created based on public input, and it will be how you want to see it. There isn't a cookie cutter tree preservation ordinance that protects every single tree. It tends to ignore weedy species of trees like box elders and other things that will just grow wherever they're allowed, but tends to focus on significant trees, and that can be spelled out by size, by species. Certainly not every single tree is going to be considered sacred. But as we increase our impervious surface and as our city grows, we need to address it by having canopy cover to provide the benefits that I talked about earlier. It serves to achieve urban forest master plan goals, without a doubt. It will outline and enforce tree protection specifications so that the trees that we want to save are being protected. And from a sustainability perspective, we just can't afford to lose canopy cover as impervious surface increases, addressing climate change and other things that go along with that urban heat island. And that's it. So I guess in summary, I would just like to say that as part of CUDE's subcommittee to work on an urban forest master plan, and I know some council members were interested in seeing that happen about a year ago, and we worked on that, and the intent of that subcommittee was to ask council for funding to create the urban forest master plan. With that plan, we will be able to identify the strengths of our community forest, where we have gaps, and formulate a consistent plan moving forward. Tree preservation may be a recommended outcome, and it may not. It just really depends on the information and the analysis of our existing tree cover before we begin to make those recommendations.
Okay, Mr. Hickey?
So I guess I still have some of the same questions I had when it was brought up at the evening meeting. You know, the scope of this, if we're talking about cataloging trees on private land, you know, everybody likes trees, but if a homeowner has a mature oak on their property and they want to take it down to build a garage, I mean, are we going to tell them they can't cut down a tree to build a garage? I mean, I don't understand where we're going with this.
Not necessarily. That depends.
Well, I would say no.
Some ordinances exclude single or double family properties, for instance.
So what if a business needs to knock down four mature oaks to expand their business again?
I would say all of that could be in the realm of a tree protection ordinance. But again, it will depend on what this community wants to see in terms of tree protection.
So again, I would think right now, we certainly manage the boulevard trees, we manage the forests, but for the city to get in the business of managing all the trees on private land, I think is a mistake. So we'll see where this goes. But
okay, and from my perspective, at one of the more recent city council meetings, there was a directive for staff to begin working on a tree preservation ordinance. So, and we're happy to do that. And that could be done on its own as a separate policy. But as a subcommittee member of the CUDE Urban Forest Master Plan Subcommittee, I think our recommendation would be to take a look at funding an urban forest master plan so that we can do an in-depth analysis of our community forest and understand the value that it has before we start making those decisions. And I believe that at October 16th board meeting, There is going to be an RCO to ask for you to fund that, and we're gaining letters of support from different entities that are in support of that venture, at which point then it may be considered that we would look at tree preservation.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Wojcik, then Mr. Campion.
So, and I, you know, there's a big difference, too, between as new subdivisions are built, you know, addressing tree preservation at that point, and then if you have established neighborhoods or businesses going in there. And certainly, you know, the details ultimately get put up to a, you know, a vote by the council at that point. I do think that, in particular, there's also a difference between preserving a tree for the sake of preserving a tree, or simply when a tree comes down as a part of a development proposal, having some offset that deals with the environmental impacts of that, which we certainly saw in the case on South Broadway, you know, some fairly sizable environmental effects. So it doesn't necessarily mean saving each tree, too. There are a lot of times it's some sort of a caliper replacement. So I'm particularly interested in the Urban Forest Master Plan, because every time I bring up these issues about preservation or dealing with invasive species, I always get told that, you know, that's great, but we need to do an Urban Forest Master Plan first. And I've been told that now for about 8 years. So I'm really, really getting excited to do this Urban Forest Master Plan so we can actually quit kicking the can down the road on this stuff and actually do the things that we are obligated and should be responsible and should be doing. I did want to ask you about right-of-way design standards, because I sent you some of the math on this, and I don't think we have anyone here from Public Works. But the two easiest things that we can do to avoid sidewalk-tree conflict is, one, pick the right species of trees.
Correct.
And we're doing that now. We're doing that a lot better than we have in the past. And the other is just giving them adequate space. And then the third one is, you know, there's actually some structural things that we can do. And some of it we're doing now with the base for the sidewalk, but I think there's also some fencing or something that you can put in there.
Root barriers.
That
will deflect the roots and protect that infrastructure.
So one of the things is, I did a quick calculation. Most of our right-of-ways, I believe, come into the city at 66 feet or 60 feet, but I think most of them come in now at 66 feet. And given the appropriate width of a neighborhood street, it's about 32 feet, which leaves 34 minus 2 4-foot sidewalks is 26 feet. What it says is on a 66-foot right-of-way, you actually have up to 13 feet of boulevard space that's available. And I know that's not how we're building it right now. We're building them with 5 to 7 feet, maybe.
I would say 3 to 7 feet.
Three even? Wow.
Yeah. they are as narrow as
so. One of the easiest things that we can do, and I know that these are templates that Public Works has, is why don't we just take a look at the design templates for these streets and just update them to allow for more space, because it's not actually changing the amount of land. And it's 13 feet for a 66-foot right-of-way, and it would be that would drop to 8 feet for a 60-foot right-of-way. But that's very good space for a tree.
Anything that could be done to widen the boulevard would be huge. I mean, that is the limiting factor.
Well, and from the standpoint, it's something that has a pretty negligible cost if you just plan for it ahead of time. So I would be interested in part of this work too of reviewing our street design templates, because it seems like there's a lower no cost solution to addressing some of the tree sidewalk conflict issues as well.
And I will say that we've changed our policies now. If there's a 3 foot or narrower boulevard, we won't plant trees on it. If the boulevard is 3 to 4 feet, we'll only plant small stature trees because the base of them can't get large enough,
right,
or it will take a long time. Not that it can't happen, but we're trying to address that given what we have to work with.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in a neighborhood with 5 foot boulevards and inappropriately planted silver maples. And I have a funny feeling there's what's going to happen in the relatively near future due to the sidewalks up there as a result of that.
Oh, yeah.
So, and that wasn't the city that authorized that tree, so that was just the developer just decided he was going to go ahead and do it. So,
Mr. Newman?
Yeah, just so we all know the realities of the budget. If the budget last year was 142 and the request is 375, an increase to 233. So we'll see, you know, where the budget capacity is. I would also say we have to find out where we're funding the $50,000 in the Urban Forest Master Plan, which has also not been identified. So I just point those out, that if you ask me how we're going to fund them, I don't have a clue yet. So we'll see.
Okay, Mr. Campion, you have a question?
I did, and now I don't.
All right. I have a question, slightly taking a slightly different tact. Are planning standards for landscaping for new development, would you characterize those as minimal or, you know, acceptable? In other words, could we require as part of new development more density in landscaping and particularly trees and landscaping of that sort?
My involvement in new developments has simply, to this point in the time I've been here, to review planting permits and approve species, not to dictate. You know, our typical spacing is 35 feet in commercial areas and 50 foot in residential areas.
I guess I'm looking more for your professional opinion. As you look at those plans and it requires X number of trees, do you look at that and say, wow, they could probably get some more trees on this property? It would be more helpful and they would still, it would not be counterproductive. It looks like Ms. Baker had a comment.
So tree placement on private properties in terms of how it's required in the ordinance is through the zoning ordinance. It's primarily commercial properties and multifamily properties that have a requirement for a certain amount of landscaping, which includes a certain number of trees. Those could certainly be increased if that's of interest. We can work with the city foresters on what would be ideal in doing that.
Yeah, I'm just suggesting that might be another avenue to increasing the overall canopy and putting in landscaping at the beginning of a project is generally far more cost acceptable, I would say. Mr. Campion?
You sparked my question, which will fall off that, which is, you know, some of the interest I have in the preservation concept is really, you know, the caliper replacement for the trees, because I know oftentimes we do have zoning standards that say how many trees, but if you take down a bunch of 80-year-old trees or even 40-year-old trees, heck, even 12-year-old trees, and you replace them with 2-year-old trees, the impact is significantly different for both that property and for the greater city. So I think from that perspective, like, if the first step is to do the master plan to understand what the objective is and agree on collaboratively what the objective is,
right.
I think that's a good first step. The second piece about the standards is, I think this principally becomes a problem in areas where we're replacing natural growth. So where there's not that many, it feels like there's not that many of them left, but where there's naturally occurring trees that are there and people see us and see developers and see, you know, the city come in and have to remove those to make way for development. I think that tends to be the most harsh kind of reality about the conversion of that land that's taking place. I think steps we can take to incentivize developers to keep that is also another kind of good step we can look at is, I know that a lot of developers do go to that length to say, like, if we can save the tree, we will. I know that there's some developers that don't. You know, that's just the reality that everyone exists that way, and they're both ends of that spectrum. So I think if we can do things to incentivize that have minimal impact, maybe that's a zoning standard, maybe that's something we can do at lot layout time, I'm not quite sure, but if we can make incentives like that at least for that aspect of the planning and zoning component, or if that's for after effect, I think, again, that kind of is a cheap, more affordable way to get the result we want, which is more of this canopy growth that we don't have.
And I think the tree preservation ordinance does incentivize people, because we're not going to prevent someone from cutting a tree down, but we are going to make them give some equitable replacement for what's being lost.
One of the, you know, understated benefits too of a tree preservation policy is it's not just the trees that you're saving, it's actually the quality of the soils that are in those native growth places. It stores a lot more carbon, it absorbs a lot more stormwater, and all of the benefits, it's, even if you were to completely grade it, everything off and plant new trees, you just don't get that benefit of the good soils underneath it for hundreds of years. And you know, the best prevention is, you know, conservation in this particular case, and saving where we can.
All right, Mr. Ruskin.
Jeff, you mentioned that your budget this year would be $230,000 that you're going to spend. Your budget was $141,519, so that's...
Well, we've spent $230,000. That's already gone. So we exceeded that budget by that amount.
Right, so, yeah, by 60, $88,000. I guess I'm kind of wondering, where are those dollars going to come from? Maybe it's a question for Paul, but is this where are the extra dollars that you've seen in the budget?
We had money reserves in that CIP account starting at the beginning of the year. I think there was roughly $250,000 or $300,000 in that CIP account that's been there. So that's just drawing down on the reserves that we had in that reforestation account.
That happens. Sometimes I don't have the CIP in front of me, but a lot of times we'll have funds from a prior year that are in there go along with the other funds.
So do we have any idea at the end of this year how much is going to be left in there?
We should be able to know from their numbers and what we had in there, sure.
Yeah.
But you're on target to spend near $400,000. Is that what I...
$375,000 will be our ask. Yeah, the plan called for about $300,000.
That's for next year.
Next year, yes.
But this year, it looked like you would be drawing on a line to be about almost $400,000.
Yeah, we're going to begin our inspections, and we're going to have to start removals immediately. And, that's the untold number that I can't really convey.
Okay, so this will be a budget consideration item, obviously. Any final question before we move on?
Well, I think it has to be asked. What is the consequence of not properly funding this? Because those reserves are going to run out. What starts to happen?
Trees die, and you can't keep up with removals, and all other forestry services will basically be put on hold in order to try to keep up with removals. I mean, that's the reality of it. Ash trees only stand for about a year or two at the most once they've died from this insect problem. And then they start falling apart. And generally, they'll fail at the base and whole trees will fall over. So in some communities in Michigan, we saw them close parks because they were full of dead standing ash trees that they didn't have time to remove. So then the next best thing is to just keep people out of there so nobody can get hurt.
And we're having a hard time keeping up with tree removal anyways. I had a citizen that was upset that there was a tree that was on our list to remove, but it fell down and hit a car or something, and are we getting some of those now where we just don't have the resources to get to the trees before they cause damage?
Well, I know the tree you're talking about, and it has spurred us to go through that entire neighborhood. There were many other maples in that area that had the same exact structural issues, and so we're doing the best we can, but I would say that we're, again, reacting more than being proactive in that.
And I understand. I don't hold the forestry department responsible for what is really a funding issue on our side, in my opinion. So.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Moving on to our next item, which is the council board and commission participation. You've got material in your packet. I'll focus on the table that was included in those materials. What I did is, based on prior council discussions and some recent action, I laid the resolution that we adopted back in February 14 against our current appointment and drew some conclusions. And then I ran this by the city attorney to just get another pair of eyes on it. So very simply, if you look at that table, those that are not highlighted, those there's really no change recommended. Those we participate based on some state law or contractual obligation or something of that nature. So those are really, they're okay, if you will. Those that are kind of tan-colored, those, there's no basis in the resolution, the prior resolution. These are more voluntary or something that are historical in nature, and I'm suggesting that on any of those, we could remove ourselves from those boards or commission. If you so chose to continue to participate on that group, you would not be allowed to participate in discussion or voting should that organization bring something forward. So that's a discussion item, but I'll work through this. That leaves the green ones, and those are ones, again, by the 2014 resolution that we sit on by virtue of the fact that our organization either sits in a city-owned facility and or receives significant funding from the city. That's what permits us to sit on those groups and also participate in discussion and voting on matters that come before the council. That's another discussion item for today, how we might want to address those. We could, and I'm recommending, we could just remove ourselves from those bodies,
Or, as an alternative, I would suggest, recently, remember, we adopted this idea that outside agencies will remit certain criteria and periodic reports. I'm suggesting one possible course is that we could remove ourselves from these groups, but then establish one new group, call it an outside agency oversight group, similar to our auditing group or something of that nature, and that smaller subset of the council would be tasked with receiving those reports and either saying everything is okay or bringing things to the attention of the full council. So that was the gist of the exercise, and now I wanted to open it up for discussion. Mr. Hickey.
All right. Remind me, what's the motivation to remove ourselves from oversight? I'll just pick one as, like, the Olmsted County Environmental Commission. So why wouldn't we want a member on that? And if we chose to leave a member on there, why would we think they would have to recuse themselves from matters that involve the Olmsted County Environmental Commission?
Well, this goes back to some discussions we've had or occasions where we run into conflicts of interest or we're unsure if there's a conflict of interest and then maybe get ourselves into some hot water. So this was an attempt to make sure we're all on the same page. I will agree with you that this feels awkward in that, so while I understand the need to maintain an arm's length relationship with groups and to maintain some objectivity when it comes to the council, by the same token, we are perhaps limiting ourselves from participation, occasions to educate, learn, and actually provide better service to our community. So it's kind of a...
So I guess I don't see that. So, I mean, there's certainly no personal financial gain. So, again, someone sits on the Olmsted County Environmental Commission. What's the conflict of interest? I don't see it.
So you're talking about the environmental...
Well, that's just one. But on any of these... We're doing this as a member of the city council.
There's basically no basis in the adopted resolution that permits us to sit there. If you want to, that's fine. Problem is if that commission would happen to bring forward some ask for funding or whatever.
So again, what would be the personal gain of a city council member on the environmental commission? I mean,
it's not the only ethical dilemma, though. It's not just
personal. Give me a hypothetical where that would be.
Environmental commission board of directors upon which you may sit, for example.
Right.
Decided to approach the council and ask for funding of a certain project, and you're on that board and you voted in favor of it. Matter now comes before the city council. You have already expressed your interest and your bias in this matter, and under the Court of Appeals decision involving the Minneapolis council member as well as an ethical practices board opinion, you're not able to render opinion on that if it's considered a quasi-judicial matter, or you have a personal interest.
Well, that I understand.
And personal interest is a conflict just as much as a financial interest. So back when we did this, went through this whole process, it was decided that if you sit on that board because the law requires it, a contract or ordinance requires it, or that 60% city-owned facility, interest or not, you should be allowed to vote on that matter that I just explained.
Correct.
If it's purely a voluntary membership, you should not.
Correct. And these aren't. These are ones where we've, as a council, appointed people. This isn't someone on their own volition. So we had the categories with the asterisk at the time.
That's what poses. And Sandra Means, when she was on here, blew a gasket, which is all over committees, had asterisks.
That's right. She should have.
And so we came up with that 60-40, that 60% facility owned by the city addition to try to appease that. Okay. Environmental Commission, to my knowledge, doesn't fit any of those.
Right.
I would ask what's the intent, right? By having someone on the Environmental Commission, we get asked, and as the current member on that, to weigh in on environmental practices that could run counter to the interests of Rochester. So on that board, I'm not there. I'm there because I was appointed under no authority by the city council. But I am acting in my city council role. It is this awkward kind of dance around what interests are being represented by having me there. Is my role to represent only the city's interests? Do I represent the city's interests? Would be another question. You know, I think that there's a whole a bunch of consideration that should be given to that. Is it just my opinion? Am I supposed to reflect the opinion of the majority of the council? What am I doing there? So, I have that problem about a number of these, which is, what is the role of the council member on that? Are they supposed to be reporting back to us about what's happening? You know, what is that relationship? And to me, I think there's a number of things that we may just be able to spend our time more focused on things we want to go after as a council. So maybe this removing ourselves from some of these boards will help us in that regard. I can understand that other people may feel otherwise, but I think that there's certainly some boards where there are conflicts, and I struggle to figure out how to isolate my participation on that board with my responsibilities to represent the financial interests of the city. That is kind of constantly in conflict. Grauk has been a great example. They've been basically redoing their entire mission. Well, what role, you know, we fund Grauk. What role should I have on that board setting the mission? Because then they come back and they go, well, Nick, you participated in setting the mission. So how can you now vote against funding the group that you helped set the mission for? And the reality is, like, all of these boards could do that. So I intentionally have to take myself out of those conversations of the board. So then you ask, what's the point of participating? I think that this is kind of a, you know, being there, I get it, has some value just to be seen in the community. But I also think, like, these are actual ethical dilemmas for people who participate in several of these boards. You know, can you, I don't see any of yours on here, but when it comes back up for funding, you know, we have to recuse ourselves. And at what point is it fair that I can be assigned by the council to a board that I then can't participate in discussions of the funding in?
Yeah, I get it.
And that was my only goal here, was to add some clarity and then some consistency, because we've run into some situations where people were unsure and it created some unneeded discussion.
I'll let Ardell finish.
Right. This refers to the council appointed. You're on there not because of the council appointed, but
this
one state law.
It's one that's state law. I am on that because of state law. Yeah.
Which one?
DMC.
DMC.
Yep.
Yeah.
So what I was going to add is that from a personal standpoint, I have more of an issue with the public board versus private board. And a lot of times private boards have expectations to maintain the confidentiality of their data. And frankly, I've been in situations where seeing that data from a city council standpoint might make me really irritated. Now you have a pretty significant conflict, a conflict between your commitments to that board and to the council. So I'm not going to universally set city council policy. You know, four of us can do that. But from a personal standpoint, I'm just saying that any of the private boards, I will not serve on, period. So if we have people that are willing to serve on those boards, and the majority of us thinks that it's something that we should be doing, we can put those people on those boards. I am going to have no part of it. And I actually have less of an issue with the Environmental Commission, because that is at least a public body where, you know, everything is public. I have a lot more issues when the public doesn't have the data practices right necessarily to go in and see everything. Now, I don't think that's a concern now with the Amateur Sports Convention or the Convention and Visitors Bureau per Mr. Atkins' comments that it is largely public data, but I don't think that unless we are able to carry with us the majority opinion of the entire city council, we should necessarily be decision makers on those bodies.
Well, again, ideally I'd like to see some more consistency, and you mentioned, I think you did, Ready. That one I have a concern with, because we know that they ask for significant dollars from the city to fund, you know, economic development. So if I would choose to continue serving on that particular board, it puts me in a dilemma because now I've got to perhaps recuse myself for the exact reason Mr. Campion said. I participated in the discussion. I voted as part of that board. I have a fiduciary responsibility to that board, and now come to the council. So am I obligated to recuse, or am I only obligated to recuse if somebody makes a stink? And that's quite frankly what oftentimes happens. Then it gets out, and it creates unnecessary acrimony.
If I could just comment on that, the three of them, Grauk, I mean, they come before you for funding. That's about the only time they come in. The Environmental Commission, we don't provide any funding for them that I'm aware of, and they don't. I don't know that they've been before you in recent memory, other than their policies could affect the county, which then could, you know, approach the things that affect us. Youth Commission, you know, they come in for their funding, and they come in for some things to go to the National League of Cities. The one that would concern me the most probably would be Ready, and from the point of view that I'm a huge fan of Ready, worked with them all these years, but they come into you for your annual funding, and then also, you know, when they do some of these loans to companies, if it's over $75,000, then you have to approve those. So having two people on there that might have to recuse themselves would be, you know, could be an issue. And I just point that out, that they have more dealings with you than the other groups.
So, Mr. Ruska, then?
Well, I guess I go to the Ready meetings. Yeah. I find it interesting to see what they're doing. And I don't really, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of changes in the financial planning. But, you know, the other option is, what if, can we recuse ourselves every time they take a vote? I mean, there's a point when you get to, you know, like every time they approve the financials, you hate to recuse yourself, because if they do it each month, it's like, you know, it sounds like you're not approving it. But I know, like on RDA, they just created it so that I, you know, I'm out, it's my last year because I've served my term out, but this is, they have it now as an ex officio, so you don't have any voting privileges, but you sit on the board. So there's some options there to create some of that, but it is complicated. There's a lot of things you look at, and you're like, you're on the boards to be informed and to kind of keep the city's viewpoint on some of these things, and I don't think there's a lot of, you know, there's any malicious meaning. It's just one of those things that gets a little bit difficult because you're trying to do all the right things, and I think groups want to have members of the city there. I know, Terry, you serve on a couple of the boards with me and so on, and, you know, that's so that they can kind of see what, you know, what is the city's policy on this, how do you handle these kind of things, so it's more informative, and you try to help these groups to move, you know.
And I would say of the TAN ones, I would think Ready is the one, I would say, probably more of a role on than others, and I think it's good to have one on there. My only question would be, if you have two on there and you lose two votes on something, then that may be, you know, a bit of a concern.
Not too many contentious votes, but yeah, I mean, I get it.
If there are, we really haven't had any, but I just pointed that out.
I'm fine with doing whatever we want to do.
Quite a few things that come out of that body that you
went. But the RDA did change their bylaws to allow a person that serves from this council to be, you know, not have a vote. So then that kind of safeguards that a little bit too.
So real quickly, one thing I wanted to do is try to provide some guidance going forward as well. I've got two groups that I said no when asked to participate. One, for example, being the Children's Museum relocation. I don't feel like I could be a part of that group. It's not on this list, and yet they will most likely at some point have come forward with an ask.
Yeah.
So it's more value to maintain my objectivity on the council rather than participate. So that was another goal, to offer some guidance going forward. Now, Mr. Campion, then Mr. Wojcik.
I actually really like the idea of having an oversight panel of council members and getting off the majority of these boards. The reality is that I think there's more and more being asked of the council members. I do think we play an important role, but I think the way we should play a role is through fiduciary responsibility for the city, and they can submit reports to us, and we can evaluate those on a quarterly basis and make sure that that information is disseminated to the entire council. I think, I mean, I hate to get too far in the weeds, but if you'll allow me for just a moment, there's also this, a lot of these boards have financial expectations of their board members, and whether that's actual codified financial expectations or that's uncodified expectations that you attend certain functions, whether those are dinners or other galas or benefits. And I think that putting council members in a position where they maybe feel a significant financial obligation to an organization by their role on the council. I would, again, it's one of these socially awkward things for a council member to have to address. I think we can just move straight out of this into a relationship that is, we appreciate what you do for the community. This is a oversight responsibility. You submit your forms for oversight, and we will evaluate them as a board quarterly. And I think that, I hate to get so transactional, but I think that that is the safest way for us to operate as a council in terms of ensuring we're objective for our evaluation.
Well, and that's why I offered that up, the oversight option, as a way to kind of mitigate, well, if you're really going to rescind your membership on these groups, the green ones, you can maybe mitigate that by having a three-member council body that would at least have some oversight.
My thought is, too, with things like READY, obviously there's an important relationship there, but I'd rather be having staff communicate back and forth and staff representing the city in those particular cases as opposed to council members. And, you know, the only standing committee of the Rochester Council is the Committee of the Whole, you know, which is it's an official...
What's that?
BAC is as well?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Is that only council members then?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Other cities use that a lot more, and I would just assume that this becomes a third standing committee. And the standing committees by default become public meetings, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, and that's what I'd like to see as well, make sure it's all public.
Board of Equalization.
That one's mixture, though, of city and county.
It is. So. And it's established by state law.
Board of Equalization?
Just the city.
No, it's
the city Board of Equalization.
That's for the last 4 years. It's just
the city. No, I've got that under state law, so I must have found a state law that requires the city to make appointments to that board.
Okay.
So I don't want to take all the rest of our time here on this topic. I wanted to introduce it and at least maybe get some discussion going. And if you've got I don't know. I would suggest either we can bring it back to do a committee hold or communicate through either the city attorney or administration and try to, again, I'd like to have some consistency. I don't know that it would be good to start to cherry pick. Well, this one, someone wants to serve on, that one not. You're inevitably going to have to, okay, when a vote comes.
Mm-hmm. People are going to be giving up positions they care about.
Yeah, so that's all I'm trying to do.
So how do you determine the three people?
Pardon?
How would you determine the three people to go that route?
I just used that model only because that's what we use for personnel group and so forth. Yeah. There would be three councilmen. Because I don't know if you get into a problem if you have four.
He's already said it's a public meeting, so...
No, but you can't.
As far as if they vote on matters.
I'm still cracking down the Board of Equalization here.
If we had this oversight body, yeah. I was suggesting that it could be three council members.
Right.
If we have a fourth council member in that oversight committee, does that create a problem?
Not from an open meeting standpoint.
Okay.
It's going to be open regardless because it's a standing committee. Right. There's a commissioner of administration opinion that says... public body's standing committee must be open to the public.
It wasn't the open meeting. It was the voting on any action. So let's say that oversight body is reviewing I'm just picking an example, an art center, their quarterly report, and they need more money.
Right.
And those four council members say, yeah, they need more money.
Right.
Have we committed an offense?
No. No, because you've established the committee. And so they're on there by way of an ordinance or some sort of council direction.
Right.
Just like Personnel Advisory Committee.
Sure.
PAC will come back and they'll say, we need to change the city's personnel policy along these lines. And they still vote when it hits the council. Same thing would be happening here.
Yeah. Mr. Bildebeck.
I guess my question, Randy, is would they just be reviewing it and coming to an idea of saying we're going to bring this back to the council for approval.
With a recommendation, probably.
Right.
Yeah. In which case, you could have four or five, whatever.
Exactly. So, I mean,
three.
To me, that just seems
like
it simplifies the whole issue.
And I think that mollifies the issue
a lot.
Yep.
Yeah,
and again, I just threw it out there for ideas, so not wedded to any of it.
You know, one thought on the standing committees is you can ask the council members if they want to be on it. If they want to be on it, they can be on it. It's that simple, and that's a great way of dealing with it. The other thing I wanted to make sure that we're clear on is that the resolution in 2014 we you know, you get the opportunity to prepare the list, but there's no statutory authority that any one person gets to prepare a list. I'm very happy to work with you on that, but I just don't want a repeat of what happened last year, where effectively I felt like I got completely blindsided, where, you know, the thing that I'm particularly interested in, you pulled me off without any discussion. You threw me on some other boards that I had no interest on. So if, you know, obviously that's a resolution that can be changed or rescinded any time. I just ask that you use that responsibility justly.
And that's why we vote on it as a council. My recommendations are only that, recommendations.
I would encourage you to work with people this time.
And I do. That's why I send out the solicitations ahead of time. Here's what you're on. What would you like to be on?
My point has been made.
Well, and I would just say that the state of the issue at hand, and for my feeling, simplifying the matter would be much easier. I would think having that board or that panel, whatever you wish to call it, then bring forward to the whole council recommendations. It's consistent.
Yeah, we can spin that all up into 2018 was kind of the theory. So it would be give the rest of the year, serve out the way it is, and notify the board that 2018 we will be changing this practice. What involvement do we have with building out the structure of a standing committee of the council? Like, do we have to lay out guidelines under which it operates to make recommendations, or who needs to report to it?
Well, if you want to, if you want to be able to have some guidance as to your mission, your roles, how you operate, what your job is, yes.
Okay, so that, I guess that's the next step.
You can keep it fairly simple. I mean, what is your purpose? I mean, for these groups, your main role is, frankly, financial. And if all their financials are coming in fine, you're probably making a recommendation one time on their annual budget, unless something is going.
I also think giving them an opportunity to file a report, so if they have, I mean, it's just another channel to get information distributed to the council if they feel it appropriate.
Mr. Hickey?
Just for what it's worth, I'll say what I said at the beginning. I think there's value in the way we do it right now with council member oversight on the individual boards, but that doesn't seem to be the direction we're moving.
And I don't disagree with the value statement. I'm just looking for some consistency if we can. And again, part of the reason for doing this now was so that when we do, you know, start to do this, you know, what are you interested in for next year? Some of these might not even be on the list anymore. So,
okay.
So, all right. We'll take that under consideration, I guess. All right. That moves to other business, and I had one item. I had Gary send out a note. I'm trying to bring closure to the service line agreement. And you'll recall from that discussion, number one, there's nothing that prohibits USP from offering their service. It's only their business that model that says they prefer the city endorsement. They provided their draft agreement. The city attorney modified that. There's a main reason, the main thing we talked about is we didn't want it to be an exclusive arrangement. They can come and work in Rochester, but we didn't want to do that to the exclusion of any other provider that might come along. He has provided that necessary edit to their draft agreement. So now the question to the council is, I was suggesting we could send that agreement back with the edit to the company. If they like it, great, we can execute that document. If they don't like it and they still want that exclusive arrangement, my opinion would be we're done.
Agreed.
No, okay.
Agreed.
And that would be my recommendation, that you not sign it as they initially drafted.
And again, we've had a couple, some members of the community that really want the service. There's nothing that says they can't get that service. This company can offer the service. So I just didn't want to.
Yeah, let's not bring it back. I agree with you.
We don't need to talk about it. I tried to handle it kind of through administration.
Are you sure there's people in the community that really want it?
Yeah.
At least one.
All right. Any other business?
Yes.
Mr. Wojcik.
Two items. 35th Street Southeast is down in the Wood Lake Business Park. It's where the Alternative Learning Center is, the high school. And there's a lot of connectivity issues with it, and one of them is that they have frequent, they do some urban gardening on some plots of land that are nearby, and there's no safe pedestrian routes to get them from their building to where these plots are. So I asked Public Works to take a look where we had pedestrian facility agreements in place where the owners are obligated to put in the pedestrian facilities. And the entire route from where they need to go to the school, is entirely covered by pedestrian facility agreements except for one parcel. So what I'd like to ask Public Works to do is come back with a, include in the 2018 work plan, putting in that sidewalk, and we'd have to go through the 429 with the one property, but even if we ended up with nothing out of them and had to pay for the whole thing, we're paying for one parcel of sidewalk to basically complete up that street. So I would like the council's consent to have Public Works take a look at that and get back to us, but it should be it should give kids a safe route to school and between school and some of their activities, and should also cost the city next to nothing.
So you're looking for information from Public Works on adding
yes
to the 2018 work
yes
plan.
Largely privately funded.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Spade?
Well, just a question. Under those head facilities agreements, did they have a date?
You know,
it sounds like you're looking to have Public Works
yep.
Law, get this info and let's get this thing built in 2018.
Yep.
Were there...
It's the 5 years after clause, which my understanding is that's long since expired.
That's
so,
my concern.
Yeah.
Is just that
but Public Works will detail that information. So... It's,
yeah, I would say I want to see how much it's going to cost.
Well,
so
there's nothing there now, so I
yep.
mean, it's an empty lot, so putting a sidewalk around an empty lot, which traditionally we don't do until they're developed.
That's the community garden area. It's actually getting to it that's the concern.
Right.
So, and again, they are obligated to provide those facilities when we deem they're needed.
We'll
so,
get a report from Public
right.
Works and see what details are, I guess.
The other thing that's been bothering me a little bit later, and we've had some discussion, but I do want to codify and possibly eliminate the ability of the clerk's department to waive parking tickets. And we've had some informal policies for some period of time where... you know, if somebody's having a meeting up here or gets inappropriately ticketed, that the clerk's office is able to waive them. And I've told people to go to the clerk's office and tell them that they're meeting with me. And the issue is that there's no real formal documentation or oversight of the program. And it's something that I think as a procedural thing opens itself up to scrutiny. So... three things I would like to see. One is my preference would be to just eliminate the clerk's office ability to waive these tickets. There's a legal process that they can go through, and this applies to elected officials and staff as well. Otherwise, at least codify the process, put a city policy in place, let's run it through the city council, let's formally approve it, because I don't want this policy sitting in the dark like that. And then the third thing is I'd like to review the fees or ask the clerk's office to review some of their fees, because some of these fees have to be enormous perpetual money losers for the work that they're putting in. Things like on a parking ticket, the city's getting $5 for all of the what's got to be an enormous administrative burden for that. And I just don't think that subsidizing parking fees is the best cost of revenue, but we could certainly review that. But in the meantime, I think it's appropriate that we do discontinue or codify the process.
Can I get a comment? Go ahead.
Yeah.
This is not a big deal. It happens maybe 10 tickets a year.
Yeah.
It's for people that like could be consultants that the city's asked to come in to give us, discuss projects with us. And they'll come in and they'll go out and have a parking ticket on their car. And we've invited them in, so basically it would be that kind of thing. Or somebody who's here for a meeting, let's say the HPC or some group like that, they come in at 3:30, they go out at 6 o'clock, they get a parking ticket on their car. You know, in our mind, they were here for a public meeting. So those are the only kind of things that are waived. It's not
well, that's what
anything
I'm going to ask.
Else.
What's the magnitude of the of
very
the
small,
problem.
Very small. And in my mind, we've always checked to see that there's legitimate reasons for these to be done. Now, we have a form that we use as a guideline, and we can use that as a codification. I can send you that, but it's a tiny, tiny issue on a yearly basis. I mean, it's, you know, if we're inviting somebody into the building to come and help us with something, and they've already got a ticket on their car, we've make that a function of doing business in this building.
I think Michael's close friend Denny Hansen wouldn't like that one, but yeah, duly noted. His name might have come up earlier. Rest in peace.
I'll send you a copy of the form, and I'll tell you how we're going to use it. We'll market it.
Can we? Yeah. You keep track of how many they have.
Yeah, it's not for this very purpose, right?
I think if we can get the form and the number, then we can.
I will say, they're never waived for somebody coming in and saying,
I have no reason to doubt any of that at all, and I don't think it's a big problem, but here's what the part that gets me is that I have, where people have had meetings with me in this building or meeting with myself and staff, and they end up with a ticket, and I've told them, just go to the clerk's office, explain it, and I shouldn't be able to do that without some form of clear documentation, because they do get waived in that particular case.
Ms. Johnson.
And do council members have a key pass or some means?
Keys aren't working.
Only ones that were hired before the technology died.
Okay. Or I'd have to pay for it.
Well, you have a
I don't have anything.
We have the governor here.
Let's leave it.
And he's here for an official meeting.
You know what?
Wow.
He can pay it until he raves late in the AC.
All right. Anything else for today, Mr. Ruska?
I noticed the buses running around town are still look pretty empty. We can get some numbers on those to kind of see. The ones I've seen lately don't have anybody in them, so I'd like to see what these new paths, new routes are doing for numbers. Thanks. Maybe just send it out to council if that's okay with them.
Yeah, that'd be great.
What's that?
Mitzi.
Oh,
I was asked to give the council an update on the schedule for the comp plan at this meeting. So just a very quick verbal. We're going to ask that the planning commission hold a special meeting at the end of November. They only meet once in November because of the Thanksgiving holiday. So if we can achieve that, we can communicate with the council before the end of the year.
Does that need to be noticed specially at the council meeting if more than four council members are
meeting? It's been my recommendation that we safely do so that a quorum of a council may be in attendance, although the council will not conduct any business at this meeting.
I think it would put that on your notice.
Yep. Hey, Mitzi, do you know what I want for Christmas? Comprehensive plan.
Thank you.
All right, we're adjourned.